Well, good day and welcome back to another episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and it's great to have everybody joining us again for another episode this week. We've got a great topic coming up for you later on in this episode. We're going to be talking about some more international response and what other countries do with response and things. So we'll be talking about that. But before we get into that, we do need to continue on and introduce the rest of the gang here. And of course, you know who's coming next, folks. That's right. Co-host Sam Bradley. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Jamie. I'm learning about Colorado's very weird weather. Yesterday, they were mowing the lawn over here, and today, as we speak, I'm looking out the window at about 3 feet of snow. It all hit overnight, and the wind blew up, blew it against all the windows and so forth. And I had to actually go out and take a mile drive this morning, and that was quite an adventure because there was no less than about 12 cars either into each other, off the side, stuck in the middle of the road. Fortunately, I have a good four-wheel drive, but I don't think I want to do that again anytime soon. Anyway, goodness. I'm sure by tomorrow, a lot of it will have melted off. That's kind of the way things work around here. So anyway, so we got Dr. Joe in Memphis, and I want to say hi to Dr. Joe. And I want to throw at you, Joe. We've had another little active shooter situation, not here, but what do you think about that?
Well, indeed we do. Hi, everybody. Another terrible tragic event in Brussels just occurred with two separate bombing incidents on some soft targets at the airport and the subway station. I had a chance to look at a little bit of that video, and sort of two things, I guess, struck me. One was I was quite amazed at the level of calmness amongst the victims there in many cases, and also the scene itself I think was very reminiscent of a lot of the scenario stuff that we do when we're training folks. And so I felt good in the fact that what we've been doing looks very much like real life, which I guess is neither good nor bad, but at least made me feel good to know that we're on the right track with that. So,
yeah, it's hard to see all these things going on, but it is at least comforting to know that when we're trying to prepare, And you especially, Joe, with Paragon, you guys trying to prepare people for the worst, that you're setting up your scenarios in such a way that they do reflect that realism, and hopefully through that prepare people just a little bit better.
Exactly right, Jamie. You know, it's we try to learn as much as we can from those events in an effort to make people better prepared for the next one. And so that was just another I guess reassuring example that we're doing things in a fashion that is very, very reminiscent of the real world.
And it's sad too that even though these events occur across the water somewhere, there's always Americans that seem to have gotten caught up in them, and that's unfortunate. Which makes you wonder how safe is the rest of the world, even though Brussels wouldn't be the first place I thought of as being dangerous, but. And that's a good segue into our topic tonight. I have a good friend, Barbara Marina. She's a physician's assistant with our DMAT team. Known her a long time. We spent time together at Ground Zero. And one country, we talked about a lot of different countries and deployments to hurricanes and so forth and other places. But, there's always, too, the what about the everyday where a lot of people don't have a lot of medical care? And we've talked to a few people who go to Haiti regularly and some other countries to just provide clinic-level medical care. Well, Barbara's had a number of adventures in that respect, and I'm just going to let her run with us. And I know she's going to talk about Cuba, and I'm sure she's got a couple other things in her back pocket because she's just one of those people that can't sit still. So, Barbara, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Sam. So in addition to being together with Sam and the entire team at Ground Zero, I also ended up, the team ended up at the Superdome and then later at the New Orleans airport during Hurricane Katrina. And then we also spent time in Haiti after the earthquake. So actually, it was, in part, the experience at the Superdome that led me to take two groups down to Cuba over the last several years of disaster responders. So those of you who, I know listen in on these podcasts, who are responders, this may end up being very interesting. But there's a couple of reasons, well, there's lots of reasons to learn about Cuba's disaster system, but for me, there were two. One is that Cuba has an incredibly effective disaster response system, even though it's actually a very impoverished country. And the other is that one of the times when I was in Cuba, I got a chance to meet with a group from their international disaster medical response group is called the Henry Reeves Brigade. And so I met with a group that had been to Pakistan, and they actually, when they go on deployment, we usually stay for like 2 weeks. But when they go on deployment, they stayed for, I believe it was 10 months in Pakistan in the winter. And you can imagine the transition from Cuba to being in the winter. But the thing that struck me was that they were not PTSD. I mean, they were like eager and ready to go back. And I was still recovering from our experience at the Superdome. So that was the other reason for my interest in trying to find out, okay, let's meet these guys. And better than that, let's have our responders meet their responders and get an idea of why they were more resilient than we were. And so I'm going to get back into that a little bit later on, when I talk about some stories. So let me start out by talking a little bit about Cuba's disaster response system, because I think there are some lessons to learn. So I work in community health centers in the Bay Area, and a lot of times when I go out and speak at community events, or even in the community health centers where I work, people don't have very many resources. I was with one elderly lady helping, to assess her house. I pointed out, if you move this, that mirror needs to come down, if you could bolt this bookcase. And her eyes just glazed over. She's a little old lady who had no resources whatsoever. And I realized that, okay, wait a minute. She's never going to do any of these things that I'm suggesting to her. It's not that she doesn't understand. It's that she can't. She doesn't have the resources to it. And the thing that would make her safest was quite simply to have a neighbor who would come in and look at her, to look after her. And that's something that I learned both in Hurricane Katrina, where a number of my patients told me that they knew that they wouldn't be alive except that a neighbor swam over and helped them to get out of their attic or helped them to get to safety. And because that is one of the strengths of Cuba's disaster response system, that nobody gets left behind. So to me, the lessons that I learned in Cuba and the system that they use in large part is something that can be applied in any community in the United States, and particularly in underserved communities. So if I had to kind of put into a nutshell why the Cuban system works better, it's basically because no one gets left behind. And we know that in Katrina, a lot of what happened is that a lot of people did get left behind. But one way to look at this, people say, is the system really as good as ours? Or, how can it really be better? We can actually compare what happened between two hurricanes that happened a month and a half apart. So, I had the experience of being in Hurricane Katrina that happened August 29th. It was a Category 3 hurricane. And in the New Orleans area, I think about 380,000 people were evacuated, maybe 100,000 people were not evacuated. And the number seemed to fluctuate, but very roughly 1,300 people in the United States died from Hurricane Katrina. Now, a month and a half before that, a more powerful hurricane, Hurricane Dennis, made landfall near Cienfuegos, Cuba. And it's very similar, you know, southern coast, population center. And so on July the 8th, a Category 4 hurricane slammed into Cienfuegos. The United States, we had evacuated about 380,000 people. The Cubans evacuated 600,000 people. So the number of people who were impacted was even larger. The hurricane was even stronger. And a very impoverished country. And they lost 16 people, which for them was a lot more than usual. Because normally in most hurricanes, we didn't lose anyone. So we lost about 1,300 people, and they lost 16 people. And very much like Hurricane Katrina, they were also caught off guard. One of the meteorologists who was down in that area told me that, you know, at the last minute they were doing, you know, they had everybody evacuated, and the last minute they were doing their calculation and realized, oh my God, the storm surge is going to be higher than we thought. And that one of their shelters was going to be inundated. So they scrambled at the last minute to reach that shelter and evacuate everybody from that shelter and move them farther inland. And in fact, when they went back after the hurricane passed, that shelter had been demolished. So they also, you know, had to scramble. It wasn't, you know, like a simple, easy one. But that's a huge difference. 16 deaths in Cuba from a more powerful hurricane that affected more people, and 1,300 deaths in the United States from Hurricane Katrina. So without going into all the things that went wrong in Hurricane Katrina, because I'm sure you guys know a lot of them, I'm going to focus on the part that is, you know, how is it that they did not leave anyone behind? And I think that the lesson for us in the United States is that our safety net has too many holes in it. And Cuba's safety net has many, many layers, as I'm going to talk about, and that's what keeps people safe. Their org charts look very much like our incident command system charts. They don't really do something that much different than we do, except that they have the safety net that involves both the neighborhoods and the medical system and the Women's Federation and all of the government that make sure that nobody gets left behind. So
if Joe and I were to run the disaster world, we'd certainly be looking to plug those holes. So I just think that's a great observation, Barbara. And, you know, I'm really anxious to see what lessons learned you are going to give us. And I wish we're able to just funnel that up to the federal government and say, hey, pay attention here. So,
well, you know, interestingly, a lot of people from the U.S. government, a lot of people who were impacted by Hurricane Katrina actually have gone to Cuba since Hurricane Katrina to learn. So I have heard that, you know, the mayor of Galveston went down, that General Honoré went down, that Ray Nagin, you know, the mayor of New Orleans, have all been down to Cuba to learn from their system. So actually, I think some of the improvements, you know, I don't know how much we can attribute those to Cuba or us just learning better, but the way that disaster response is being approached now, which is more community-based, is a whole lot closer to that safety net concept.
Excellent.
So let me give you an...
Yeah, I was saying that's excellent. I'm glad to hear that people are taking advantage of learning what the Cubans have to offer.
Yeah. Or, you know, that reinforcing things that maybe they had already thought and coming back and saying, you know, no, this really works. This really works, and I've got reasons why. So let me give you a picture of what a hurricane evacuation looks like in Cuba and how that's somewhat different. So the evacuations themselves, the executed at the local level. So they have neighborhood associations called the CDRs. We don't quite have the same thing here. I think the closest thing that I could think of would be neighborhood watch groups, except that neighborhood watch groups in the United States are spotty, whereas in Cuba, every single Cuban is part of a neighborhood association. They're kind of like precincts. Because they also get involved in elections, and they also get involved in things like vaccination campaigns. So anyway, the evacuations, the people who actually run the evacuations are neighbors. And so when we ask them, well, how do you make sure that nobody gets left behind? They look at us in horror, and they say, how could we leave someone behind? Well, in the United States, people always get overlooked. They said, but there are neighbors. And so, of course, we don't leave them behind. We know everybody who lives, you know, in our neighborhood. And we know who needs help. And we know who's alone. And we know who's grumpy. And we know, who's got too many kids. And that as neighbors, they make sure that everybody is able to evacuate. And when one of our group members said, oh, you know, I've lived in my neighborhood for 13 years and I still don't know my neighbors, they were like horrified. So
I think that's the key, Barb, just to jump in. But it sounds like Cuba runs like a nationwide CERT team, you know, because people that are trained at the citizens emergency response level, you're going to have those neighborhoods where people have reached out and said, okay, this is how we're going to prepare the whole neighborhood for a disaster. But I think your friend was well spoken. We just don't know our neighbors as much as we probably should. And I'm as guilty of that as anybody. So I think that makes a strong point.
So then that segues right into the next level of the safety net, which is healthcare. So when a hurricane is approaching, every single Cuban is attached to a primary care home. And in most cases, it's their neighborhood doctor. Most Cubans are not more than a few blocks away from, you know, their primary care home. But what happens as a hurricane approaches is that every doctor nurse team that works in neighborhood comes up with a plan for every single one of their patients so that it, long before the hurricane comes, if somebody is medically fragile and really should pass the hurricane in a hospital, then they get transported to a hospital like days before the hurricane hits. And then on the other hand, a lot of hospitalized patients are actually sent home to be with their families. So they then have a plan and they figure out, you know, which patients need to be in the hospital. All women in their last month of pregnancy end up going to the hospital. And then if they have patients who simply need supervision, but they don't need to be in the hospital, usually either the nurse or the doctor evacuates with those patients to the government shelter so that they will be medically supervised throughout the hurricane. And then they may have patients who, you know, they don't really need to direct supervision, but they just make sure that everything's okay, that they've got their medications, or, you know, one doctor told me that, you know, she had a patient, Mr. Gonzalez, who, when he evacuates, he goes to his neighbors, but he always forgets his medicine. So she goes to the neighbors and makes sure that the neighbor knows, you know, Mr. Gonzalez is going to go to your place, you know, when the hurricane comes, here are his medications. Please make sure that he takes them twice a day.
And that's awesome. And if you
don't do that, please make sure.
Let me just jump in and see. I'd love to see what Dr. Joe thinks about this concept.
Oh, I think it's a great idea. You know, if I recall properly, in Cuba, most everyone has an assigned physician. You know, the physician's responsible for about 1,000 lives. And, you know, this absolutely fits in with that whole idea that he's there to help manage all of their issues. And I had not really thought about this in terms of a disaster response, but what a fabulous idea to be ahead of the game, proactively making arrangements for those patients that you're never going to have problems. I think it's wonderful.
And I think that's a real key to what Barbara's talking about. Jamie, any thoughts?
No, I'm just really, I like the concepts, like Joe said, of really recognizing and planning ahead of time for those fragile patients that we all know who they are. If we have one in our neighborhood, or if in my instance, those patients we see more frequently on ambulance calls, and it's kind of catch as catch can if they are on our radar or not directly as a formal response during this type of situation. So it's something definitely that could be learned and applied nationwide in some respect with regards to our own emergency response.
Barbara, see if I'm thinking along the right line here, but it's almost like the Cubans expect there's going to be a disaster. There's going to be a flood. There's going to be a hurricane. Where it seems like a lot of Americans are living in denial with the old, it can't happen to me, it just happens to everybody else. Is that part of what's going on here, do you think?
I think that that's part of it. But also wherever it is so one thing that's different for them than what we face here in California is that they know when the hurricanes are coming. And they actually have an outstanding meteorologist who it's not that well known that, in all of this time that, there's been this boycott and, there's no communication and things like that. Very quietly, NOAA has continuously been in contact with a Cuban meteorologist, and that never stopped because there was a critical hurricane that hit the United States where the Cubans had it right on and the U.S. meteorologists had it wrong. And this happens. I mean, it's always, computer models and guesses, but the Cubans are actually really have outstanding meteorologists who take an active role in informing the public and saying, well, this might be a low number, like this might only be a category one hurricane, but it's bringing torrential rains and there's going to be flooding. And so they talk about this because, the Cubans tell me that a fast-moving category five hurricane is actually less deadly than a stalled tropical storm because there's wind damage with a category five hurricane. But if it's moving fast, it'll blow through, it'll knock things over. But if we've sheltered everybody, then we're good. But when there's torrential rains over a long period of time, that's when the flooding is overwhelming and people get swept away. So this is something that the meteorologist will actually go on to national television and locally where the hurricane's going to hit and talk to people. You've got to take this one seriously. We've got to evacuate farther inland and things like that. Okay. So another level of the safety net is the role of the Women's Federation. So we don't have an equivalent in the United States, but the Women's Federation, so many women are members of the Women's Federation that there is a Women's Federation representative in every one of the neighborhood associations. And their role is to, they know all their neighbors, and this is kind of what they do. So they know and have responsibility for anybody who needs assistance. So they'll know, like I said, that there's an elderly gentleman who maybe doesn't have any medical problems, but he gets easily confused. And so the Women's Federation will make sure that, he gets the assistance that he needs, or a woman whose husband is away and has six kids and she needs assistance, so that they, that's another group that's going around. So you have the neighborhood association who's organizing to make sure that every single person in their neighborhood association has a plan for where they're going to go. You've got the nurse, doctor, primary care team that are making sure that every single person has a medical plan and that, somebody needs medications, that they have them, that somebody's looking after them. So if somebody maybe didn't quite hook up with where they're going to go, then the doctor, nurse team might notice that. And then on top of that, you've got the Women's Federation, who plays more of this kind of social case manager role, who's also checking on everybody. And one of the ways to look at it is that in Cuba, the bad thing is that everybody's in everybody else's business, and the good thing is that everybody's in everybody else's business. So every neighbor, everybody's known to other people. And that's kind of their safety net. And then two other examples is that a lot of kids go to boarding schools, especially in the rural areas, and all of the schools out, you know, that have been built in the countryside are actually built for hurricane resistance. And so those become shelters. They're high above ground. I've seen them, and they all actually look very similar to each other. Reinforced concrete with open breezeways, and they're built so that they can withstand the hurricane force winds. And the other thing that's fascinating is what happens with their polyclinics. So I work in community health centers that are primary care, and their polyclinics, there are some differences, but they're kind of similar. And one of the things that I've been trying to establish a role for community health centers in disasters in the United States, because some counties say, well, you know, their clinics, they should just close. But actually, as primary care centers, there's a whole lot that we can do to stabilize patients. But in Cuba, the polyclinics get converted to be medical outposts. So they send home all of, you know, about half of their staff actually goes home to be with their families, and about half of their staff volunteers to stay. And then the hospital sends strike teams out to the community health centers. So they usually send a surgical team out to the health center to be able to manage trauma. And, you know, or they'll send pediatricians or whatever kind of specialized strike teams that are needed. And then those polyclinics, because they are in the neighborhoods, then become an easier way for people to get to care faster rather than us trying to transport them. You know, like in the United States, we try to transport them to the regional centers or to the regional hospital, which can be very problematic. Jamie, you probably know that way better than I do.
Absolutely.
And that's going to wrap up part one of what has become a two-part episode here at the Disaster Podcast. We want to thank all of you for checking out the program. Make sure you check back next week for part two of this episode, where you can hear the rest of this discussion. But we needed to cut it short and respect your time, as well as make sure that we had something extra for you next week. So we'll do that. And in the meantime, I want to thank our sponsors, Paragon Medical Education Group. You know, without the amazing assistance they provide to us to make this podcast continue to be recorded, we couldn't do the show. So we want you to go out and thank the Paragon Medical Education Group. Head over and check out their website. Say thank you. Thank them for supporting the podcast. If you are part of a disaster response system or an EMS system or a police agency or even a hospital system, maybe you need to talk to them about bringing them in to do some amazing preparatory work where you can be more prepared for the disasters that might strike your community. So make sure you check them out. You can find them over on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can also check them out on Twitter at paragonmededu. And of course, you can always leave a message for them here at the Disaster Podcast at disasterpodcast.com. And we always like to get those comments here. So if you want to leave a comment, we will get back to you. We will shoot you an email, and we will leave a comment right here on the site in reply as well. So make sure you're coming over and visiting us at disasterpodcast.com, where you can find all of our episodes and, of course, the ability to have a conversation with us via our comment section on each episode as well. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, on behalf of Sam Bradley and the rest of the team here at the Disaster Podcast. We want to thank you for joining us, and remember that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.